The next time you visit the airport in Singapore, I hope that you'll confirm this for me. I read recently that as you exit the restrooms in the Singapore airport, you will find a touchscreen mounted on the wall by the exit. And this touchscreen displays a single instruction: please rate our toilets. And below that instruction is a picture of the employee on duty whose job it is apparently to keep the restrooms clean and whose job evidently is dependent on whether you give him or her good or bad reviews. But below that person's picture are five smiley face buttons labeled excellent, good, average, poor, and very poor. Plus, there's a message, this screen is sanitized regularly. Actually, at the early service, I had someone that told me that's exactly the way it is. She had been there recently. But that's pretty, that's new and different. A restroom survey, I mean, we're familiar with questionnaires asking about service and quality and price. I mean, if you go to a restaurant, you're accustomed to the server handing you a receipt, and at the bottom it says you get a free appetizer or something if you give them feedback on your meal, that dining experience that night. Or you go to a department store or a hardware store, and there will be a little QR code on your receipt that says if you go to this website, you might be entered for a drawing for a valuable gift card. I'm part of a season ticket group for the Indians, and so anytime I attend a game, I always get a survey a couple days later asking me about my satisfaction of my game-going experience. Did I have any food or drink? How was the food? How was the service? What did I think of the entertainment between innings? If you go to the doctor these days, you know you're going to get a survey about how was that doctor's care, the nurse's care. By the way, when I was writing this sermon on Tuesday or Wednesday, I took a call here at the church. It was an automated message asking if our new phone books had been delivered here. And at the end of that call, the automated voice invited me to call a number to rate their automated call. Honest to goodness, I didn't. But what if we were to give ourselves a satisfaction survey about our church? I want you to do that. I want you to first turn to the front page of your bulletin, the cover of your bulletin, and then find a pen, maybe in the pew rack in front of you, or maybe the pew in front of you or behind you, you'll find a pen. Or in the fellowship register, if you have to stand up, you'll get a pen. Do that now. Find yourself a pen. Let's evaluate ourselves. If you're ready, hold your pen up in the air. I want to see it. Looks pretty good. Okay, here we go. On the line following the number one, I want you to write friendliness. You have to do this fast. We're going to move along here. Friendliness. Okay, now, in that line, circle the smiley face that you think most accurately reflects our church's friendliness to visitors. Are we excellent? Are we good? Are we average? Are we poor? Are we very poor? Moving on to line two. The line after number two, I want you to write the word worship. After the number two, write the word worship. How relevant, how engaging, how meaningful, how inspiring does worship tend to be here for you? Circle the smiley face that captures your level of satisfaction with worship. Is your worship experience tending to be excellent, good, average, poor, very poor? Moving on. After the number three on that line, I want you to write the word difference. Difference. D-A-F-F-E-R-E-N-C-E. Difference. To what degree does our church make a difference in people's lives, make a difference in the world? Do we do an excellent job? Good, average, poor, very poor? Now let me pause here. I should note that your feedback is always welcome. Whether it's an affirmation of what we're doing or you have some constructive criticism to share. For example, our worship committee considers all feedback it receives about the content and the setting of our services. And for that matter, any feedback we receive is shared with the appropriate group, whether that needs to be heard by the deacons, by the session, by the office staff, anyone. So we always appreciate feedback. But now back to this morning's survey. My hunch is that most of us tend to give ourselves pretty good marks. We're halfway through this survey. This kind of survey is kind of like looking into the mirror. We look in the mirror and we say to ourselves, we're good folks. We're a friendly lot. We're open to anybody. Certainly we're doing the best we can to honor God by trying to be like Jesus. At least we're average, if not good. Modesty might prevent us from rating ourselves excellent. But wait a moment. After all, how we rate our effectiveness in following Jesus is really of little importance. What really matters is what others say, or even what others believe about how well or how poorly we embody the teachings of Jesus in our day-to-day dealings with the world. So let's move on in the survey. Now I'm going to go even quicker here. Are you ready? After the number 4, write the word public. Public, P-U-B-L-I-C. Here we go. How do you think the general public in Rocky River, or whatever community you live in, how do you believe the general public would rate Rocky River Presbyterian Church for having a positive impact on the community? Circle something and just move on. For number 5, I want you to write after the number 5 the word margins. Margins, M-A-R-G-I-N-S. How would you rate our church's influence and impact? Pardon me. How would our church's influence and impact be rated by people who are often pushed to the margins, the edges of society? Now, so you can picture these folks who so often are invisible to us, let me give you a few examples by way of description. Picture the guy at the top of the West 25th Street exit ramp holding a sign asking for food. How would he rate his satisfaction with our church? Or consider the hundreds of homeless men who feel themselves fortunate to be able to sleep dormitory style every night at the men's shelter at 2100 Lakeside. How would they rate their satisfaction with our efforts to love neighbors as we love ourselves? Or how about the dozens of men and women who are released from prison every week, who struggle to reestablish themselves as respectable contributing members of society? How would they be satisfied or not satisfied with what our church is doing to help them redeem their lives? Or how would our acceptance be rated by people who look to the LGBT Community Center of Greater Cleveland for support and advocacy? Again, all this is number 5 that you can use to rate how satisfied marginalized persons in our communities would be. How satisfied would they be with our stated goal of loving God with all that we've got and loving neighbors the way we love ourselves? What mark would they give us? And finally, after number 6, write the word peeps. Peeps. P-E-E-P-S. Peeps. What result would we expect if we handed out satisfaction surveys to our peeps, that is, to the people closest to us? How would our children, spouses, co-workers, next-door neighbors, how would they rate the quality of service and love that they receive from us? Circle something. Okay, now we're going to shift gears. The survey was simply a little exercise. You don't have to turn it in. Though again, I'll remind you, we are always appreciative of feedback of any kind here at the church. In a way, today's gospel reading described a self-administered satisfaction survey. Luke's presentation of Jesus telling the Good Samaritan story, one of the most familiar and favorite stories in the Bible. The example of the Good Samaritan has inspired many states to enact laws offering legal protection for individuals who try to help a victim in distress. They often call them Good Samaritan laws. But Jesus told this story, in this instance, to prompt his listener to give himself a satisfaction survey, a survey about how well or how poorly he himself was living up to what God wanted of him. Now remember, it was a religious law scholar who approached Jesus. And he approached Jesus not out of a sincere desire to learn, but rather to try to trap Jesus into saying something foolish or something heretical. He wanted to get him in trouble. This religion lawyer began by tossing Jesus a softball, an easy question. He asked, "What's my obligation in order to be eternally blessed?" Now, Jesus knew that this religious lawyer knew the answer, and so Jesus said, "You tell me. What must you do?" The lawyer recited the ancient text that instructed believers to love God with your entire being, heart, soul, strength, mind, and love your neighbor as you love yourself. Jesus nodded, but then the religious lawyer tried to trap Jesus. He asked, "But love your neighbor, Rabbi. What constitutes a neighbor? How is that defined? Who does that include?" Jesus didn't answer the question. Instead, he told a story. He told a story about a man who was mugged while traveling from Jerusalem to Jericho. The victim's fellow countrymen didn't stop to help, not even a priest, not even a temple worker, two fellows whose livelihood supposedly kept their focus on God. No, they didn't help. It was an out-of-towner who stopped. And not just an out-of-towner, but one from Samaria, a region that most Israelites despised, and the feeling was mutual. Jews and Samaritans. Think Cavaliers and Golden State. Cleveland and Pittsburgh, Columbus, Ann Arbor, you get the picture. And yet, who was it who came to the aid of this robbed and beaten Jew than a fellow traveler from, of all places, Samaria? We know the rest of the story. The Samaritan bathed the man's wounds with his own oil and wine, then took one of his t-shirts, tore it into strips, and bandaged the bleeding wounds. An outlay that the Samaritan had not expected to make. The Samaritan walked, having hoisted the injured man onto his own donkey, an unexpected inconvenience. He took the man to an inn to rest and heal, an unexpected detour. He spent the night treating the man, an unexpected delay. He gave the innkeeper money to continue the care, an unexpected expense. And he promised to pay for whatever ended up costing more, an unexpected commitment. But once Jesus had finished that story, a story that I think is at the same time heartwarming and disturbing, once he finished that story, Jesus asked the religious law scholar the question that the scholar had asked him. Jesus said, "Who is a neighbor? Which of the three acted like a neighbor?" Now, we have to hope that that scholar had a genuine aha moment of realization after hearing that story. Which was the neighbor? Well, it wasn't the one who, to his credit, knew the scriptures inside out. It wasn't the one who, to his credit, was meticulous in how he observed all the rituals and traditions of his religious community. No, the one who acted like a neighbor to the victim was the one
who showed compassion. The neighbor was the one who showed compassion.
In Luke's telling of this encounter between Jesus and the scholar of religious law, what emerges is that the lawyer was asking the wrong question for the wrong reason. What mattered was not whether the lawyer was doing what he had to do so he could get into heaven. Jesus showed that what mattered was if the lawyer was doing all he could to address unmet needs in the world. Was he allowing God's grace to work through him to give him sincere compassion in order to notice and serve people facing profound critical needs? As a church, from time to time, we make decisions about what mission projects to get involved with, what programs warrant our financial support, other kinds of support. There's always more to be done than we can do. So through discussion and in prayer, we discern what our compassionate response will be. We discern where God wants us to place our efforts now, recognizing that that can change over time. Isn't that true for us individually, too? There are always more appeals for our time, our energy, our financial gifts, always more appeals than we can satisfy. I mean, there are so many wonderful, deserving religious and secular organizations locally, nationally, globally. And there are a few unscrupulous outfits that we have to be careful to steer clear of. But for each of us, we're guided by our sense of compassion to decide what we can do. Not for whatever good it might bring our way, but for all the good we can do to meet needs in the lives of others. As we heard from Paul's letter to the Colossians earlier, we ask God to fill you with the knowledge of His will, with all wisdom and understanding that His Spirit gives. Then you will be able to live as the Lord wants, and will always do what pleases Him. Your lives will produce all kinds of good deeds, and you will grow in your knowledge of God. As I said earlier, how we rate our effectiveness in following Jesus is really of little importance. What really matters is what others say, or even what others believe about how well or poorly we embody the teachings of Jesus in our day-to-day dealings with the world. Both individually and as a church, we strive to make sure that the things we say and do are guided by compassion. When we allow compassion to be our guide, we don't worry about whether we're earning good ratings in the eyes of others. Loving God with all our heart and soul and mind and strength, loving our neighbors as we love ourselves, those words are far, far more than religious platitudes intended to be embroidered into some decorative church banner or to be listed in some church's written mission statement. No. Those words are a watchword. They're a constant reminder that Jesus calls us to care for those who may be the least assuming, who may possess great needs, to care for them with compassion, for to us they are like brothers and sisters. To us, they are neighbors.
They are neighbors.